This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Welcome to Classical Ideas. This is Greg Soden. I'm looking forward to making new episodes again soon, but I am so excited to bring you another guest-hosted episode with Dr. Arlene Sanchez-Walsh. Dr. Sanchez-Walsh's guest-hosted episodes have been a joy for me to listen to, and these collaborations have been very inspiring. In addition to this episode on Brazil and the book Migrational Religion, Context and Creativity in the Latinx Diaspora, Dr. Sanchez-Walsh hosts episode 207 with Dr. Felipe Hinojosa, episode 227 with Dr. Christy Naben-Warren, episode 228 with Dr. Brett Hendrickson, and also appears as a guest in conversation with me on episode 176. Without further delay, please enjoy Dr. João Chaves in conversation with Dr. Arlene Sanchez-Walsh on the Classical Ideas Podcast.
Okay, welcome to Classical Ideas Podcast. I'm guest host, Dr. Arlene Sanchez-Walsh, professor of religious studies at Azusa Pacific University, and today I am interviewing Dr. João Chaves, whose new book is called Migrational Religion, out at Baylor University Press. And it's just a fascinating look at migration and religion, and the intermingling of ethnicity and religion and identity, and you know what we make of this great kind of paradox of our times of just masses of people who are considered illegal, and how we can overcome such things, how churches try and overcome it, how pastors live through that kind of an idea. Some more than others find themselves pressed to become activists, and some don't. But that's what we want to talk to Dr. Chaves about today. So welcome, Dr. Chaves. Thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me. I'm looking forward to this talk.
All right. So give us some background, a broad overview. This book is about Brazilian Baptists. Numbers, a little bit of historical background, kind of set the table for us about what we're going to be discussing over the next hour.
Well, thank you. Yeah, so the book is a part two of a longer project that deals with my particular interest, research interest, which is the construction and the maintenance of Brazil-US networks, religious networks. The first half of this part of my dissertation, an expanded second half of my dissertation, in the first half, I tried to trace the history of Southern missionaries in Latin America, paying particular attention to issues of race and religion, and how the presence of Southern missionaries shaped Latin American evangelicalism in general. But I look at Southern Baptist missionaries in particular. But in tracing that history, around the 1980s, the Southern Baptist Convention and the networks that they've created in Brazil through the Brazilian Baptist Convention begins to get concerned, particularly at churches in the East Coast begin to wonder how they can do better at reaching the immigrant communities in the East Coast particularly. And this is where this story starts in a way, the story of Brazilian Baptist networks and the churches that they began created in the United States, when churches in the East Coast start to recruit Brazilian missionaries to preach to Portuguese enclaves in the East Coast and some in California, rather than the Brazilians. So this story begins with, again, Southern Baptists wanting to bring Brazilian Baptist missionaries to preach to Portuguese enclaves in the U.S. But in the 1980s, there's also mass migration from Brazil, mostly because of push and pull economic factors, but there are other factors at play as well. And these ministers that come here begin to notice this influx of Brazilians, and they begin creating Brazilian churches. And then as this story develops, what begins with a denominationally controlled kind of story begin to be more characterized by loose networks that do have a denominational identity and affiliation at some points, but are more fluid than that. But the question that I'm pursuing here, particularly with these groups, as I began to study them and to visit churches and to do some archival work in churches, and also to have my own experience as a Brazilian who have lived some of these dynamics, was a question that sometimes in dialogues that deal with world Christianity is less asked, because often the question that is asked within world Christianity in general, when especially when one's looking at broad regions, is how are immigrants changing the U.S. or changing Europe? The question that is less asked is how is the migration experience in this country is actually changing the immigrants and the immigrant communities, and in this particular stance or instance, these religious communities. So I'm trying to understand here or trace a historical account, but also with an ethnographical interest as well, or how this migration experiences over time change the identity of these religious communities, rather than the most often asked question, which is how are these communities changing the U.S. religious landscape? I'm trying to look at this a similar dynamic, but through a kind of a different angle.
Yeah, that was interesting. That part of the book where it just strikes me, anybody, and I don't generally study missions, though you almost can't help it, right? When you do Latinx, Latino, Latin American religion, you just automatically study missions. But the pragmatic, the relentlessly pragmatic approach of like, we're just going to get people who know Portuguese to go to the East Coast and talk to, you know, Portuguese speaking people in these churches who have very little relation at all to Brazil, other than they are Portuguese speaking. Am I correct? Or are some of them, were some of these churches that you were looking in the East Coast, did they have a Brazilian group there already? Or was it mostly Portuguese speaking?
Yes and no. I mean, those neighborhoods that changed. So for example, the first Brazilian Baptist missionary comes to Newark, to Walnut Street Baptist Church. There was second German church in Newark at one point. Then the neighborhood changed to speak English, and then changes again to speak Portuguese. So if you look at the minutes of the church, they shift from German to English to Portuguese from Portugal to Brazilian Portuguese. So I mean, there's not a direct connection there, other than the neighborhoods changed. These churches don't have the resources to reach because of linguistic barriers. So right. And then they call Brazilians in. So in that sense, there is not a deep connection. But in another sense, there are deeper connections. Mm-hmm. Since 1911, Brazilian Baptists have missionaries or have a mission in Portugal. So is the second oldest mission from the Brazilian Baptist Convention. The first was Chile in 1908. The second was Portugal in 1911. And by the time the Brazilian Baptist Convention sent missionaries to the U.S., they are already trying to reach the Portuguese enclaves in Canada. So it's not a surprising option or a new option.
Yeah.
There is no connection to these communities necessarily when these missionaries come, but there is in the Southern Baptist and the Brazilian Baptist mentality both, this idea that if you want to reach the Portuguese Roman Catholic, the Brazilian Baptist is the one to call, right? So in that sense, that is a connection there already.
Yeah, thank you. You used two terms in the book, and I wanted you to clarify it for our listeners. One is Brazuca and Brazilian. If you just unpack that for us so we know, if you use those terms interchangeably, will we be doing them justice, or how should we define those terms?
Well, yeah, thank you for the question. What the Brazuca is a term that it's already in the literature of Brazilian migration to the U.S. For a while. And it basically means, the way I use it and most use it, a Brazilian, first generation Brazilian immigrants in the United States. Whereas when I use Brazilian, I'm often referring to other Brazilians that might be in Brazil or might be here, but not as migrants in the same way. So all I mean by Brazuca there is Brazilian immigrants here. I use Brazuca churches a lot, but just to mean that when I say Brazilian churches, I'm probably saying that these communities are in Brazil. Whereas when I talk about Brazuca, I'm talking about communities or in groups that are here, but are predominantly comprised of Brazilian immigrants.
Thank you. I'm just curious, because I read in the looking through the book is this religious competition, which is always so fierce, as you know, and it has been for centuries in Latin America, Catholic and Protestant, Protestantisms of various stripes, and Catholicisms actually of various stripes. The animus historically between both, kind of going back and forth. Any evidence that you saw that was brought over as kind of did that migrate as well? The desire to reach Brazilian Catholics here as opposed to reaching Catholics in Brazil, the animus that has been there historically amongst more sectarian Protestant groups vis-a-vis Catholics. What did you find?
Yeah, this is also an evolving phenomenon, right? Whereas you see in Brazil today, a sort of a, what we call the, some people call Paul Freston, a sociologist called Bolsonaro, for example, the first pan-Christian president of Brazil, when you have some coalitions between Roman Catholics and evangelicals around the new conservatism of the country. And because we live in a hyper-connected world, that development happened within church communities here too. But in terms of evangelism, it is very much another one of the heritages of the Southern Baptist Convention, the fact that Brazilian Baptists are very much anti-Catholics. In generally speaking, they do have a very distinct opposition to some Roman Catholic traits, but what informs that also is anti-Protestant violence that had happened in Brazil up until a few decades ago, especially in the interior. So I mean that are a lot of that's a lot of historical tension there to speak about, but they do bring that here. Yes, definitely. When they begin these missions here to reach the Portuguese, there is no doubt that it is to convert Portuguese people from Catholicism to Protestantism, what the missionaries will call convert them to the true gospel of Christ. Right. So in that language itself, you see already. Sure. A kind of antagonism in some ways, and kind of disposition towards proselytism. And also another interesting aspect in these communities that I have seen, not all of them, but some of them, mm-hmm. because of the different forms of of members that show up in these churches. Not all of them are Baptist. The church is a Baptist. The leadership is Baptist. They are connected to the Southern Baptist Convention. But the members that show up sometimes come from Presbyterian backgrounds, from Methodist backgrounds, who have been baptized as infants. And sometimes they're allowed to transfer their membership without having to be baptized by immersion, which they wouldn't be in Brazil. But some pastors allow every kind of infant baptism but Roman Catholic. Oh, if you're Roman Catholic, you can't, right? So shows that kind of antagonism, mm-hmm. that in some ways, again, I mean, it's getting less pronounced, but it has been something that goes both ways. I mean, myself as one who was raised in Brazil as a Protestant minority before the explosion of Pentecostalism in the region, it was never lost on me that there is also animosity in the direction of Protestantism from the Catholic majority. I mean, and so it's a negative animus, as you call it, that goes both ways, and it goes both ways in communities, religious communities in the U.S. as well. Although it's a developing dynamic, and in a way, it has found some spaces for coalitions under the new administrations for reasons they are not necessarily to be celebrated, but nevertheless.
yeah. Well, you know, that's a whole different podcast, Brazilian politics.
That's right.
I don't know that would make you popular or not. Maybe with some people, very. Maybe with some people, not. Who knows? It's ongoing. And there's, you know, this is an aside, but it is interesting, you know, to be on that Protestant side, right? I mean, you grew up and it just dominates. It's everywhere, you know. Catholicism, the mm-hmm. the churches, the architecture, the pop, you know, the folk Catholicism. You know, it's seeped into the culture for centuries. You know, and it's quite unique. I don't know that immigrants here appreciate, maybe beyond this first and second generation, if they really appreciate how deep some of that animus goes. It does.
And I reviewed an excellent book recently by Erica Hilden, Religious Conflict in Brazil. When I tell a story that happened to me when I was growing up. Erica deals mostly with the from the 1920s to the 1940s. But I remember growing up as a teenager, and very vividly, and again, I recount that story in my review essay, where I'm coming out of the church, and I see people talking. You know, there's some commotion happening, and I come to the group of young adults. They're older than I was, and the story that they were telling is that one of their families that lived in the interior. I was from a larger town. This wasn't common there. But this person's family lived in the interior, and they had allegedly the story that they were telling was that they were stoned, for being Protestants and defying the authorities, there. I mean, you have Frei Damião, whom I've met, a friar that was a Capuchin friar, very famous in the region. He was in process of beatification now. And Erica problematizes this process itself. It was very much engaged in anti-Protestant violence in the interior. So I don't think that this negativity from the Protestant side to the Catholic side is justifiable at all. But there are some very recent historical reasons that maintain it because this. These stories, I know, are deployed and redeployed.
Of course.
Even when they stop happening, and even in my generation, they were still going on. That's not to say that when Protestants are in power, they won't do exactly the same, right? But the way in which the history developed, I think, has something to say about this.
Yeah. Well, these narratives, they you're exactly correct. They're deployed for a certain end. right? They're not, yeah. if they'll shrivel up and be revamped into something different if they don't serve their purpose, right? But because they serve their purpose, they're repackaged and revitalized and targeted at different groups, different times for different reasons. But it's always, you know, generally on both sides, it's very self-serving, right? To maintain some kind of separation between the two, to make sure that everybody knows that they're different, right, that they're separate, and that we're right and we're right and we're right. And it's like a never ending thing, unfortunately. I am talking to Dr. João Chaves, and his book is Migrational Religion, from Baylor University Press. My name is Arlene Sanchez-Walsh, guest hosting here on the Classical Ideas podcast. This was a really good quote, and I'm gonna read it back to you, and then we'll talk about what you mentioned here, unpack it for us a little bit, unbelonging. So quote, ethnic denominationalism is an institutional manifestation of the anxieties of unbelonging, great quote, raised by complex migrational dynamics. So first of all, what is unbelonging in the people that you researched here, that you spoke to, and you did research in the archives, and how does that play out in this complexity of migration and religion that you studied for your book?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for that quote. So the part of what I'm trying to show here in the book, I think that captures a lot of what I'm trying to show, that quote itself, is it's how this distance from displacement from what you know, from language, from groups with which you have some kind of, you feel like you have some kind of solidarity, theologies and religious dynamics that fulfill needs that are created by these dislocations of migration. These are all things that create this sense that these groups don't belong to society, and here there are lots of overlaps with other immigrant groups as well. Right? So there are some particularities to the way in which this happens in these Brazuca communities, but that's also lots of overlap with others. Here I'm looking primarily how unbelonging develops in first generation Brazilian immigrants, but there is unbelonging in other generations too. I see, you know, some of that in my own kids because of being, you know, minoritized in primarily white communities in some ways. And although I live in San Antonio, they don't experience as much as they would have if they lived in other places. But it is there. So I realize that this unbelonging is broadly shared by folks that are minoritized in the U.S. But here, I look at how this idea or this anxiety of just not being from this place, and that's been always so evident, not having papers, many, an estimate of 70% of the members of these communities either were undocumented or had been undocumented before. So, I mean, how can you belong in a place where you can't even, you know, have proper documentation, the idea of language, and also something that develops within Brazilian immigrants that is also something that is a lively debate in the literature, primarily within sociology of Brazilian immigrants, is what sociologists call the myth of return. Is that Brazilian immigrants, and this is, I asked the pastors that I interview about this, and they didn't know, of course, about the literature, but they said it in their own ways that they see this. They always talk about the fact that one day they will go back. So they are not here thinking, I'm going to build my life here, my kids are going to live here, we're going to be here generations. They come thinking, they are target earners, right? They, at least that's how they see themselves. Many stay, but they stay, you know, still with deploying the narrative that one day when they have this much, they will return. So there is not intentional horizon of even trying to belong in some ways, because this is not a place where I will stay. This is not the place where I'm going to retire. This is sometimes some of them would even say, this is not the place where I want my kids to grow up. I'm here because I have an objective. I need to, you know, make some money to start a business there, to help some family member, and then I'll return. So one of the pastors I talked with, I quote him in the book, he says, Brazilians don't migrate to the US, they come. they come, yeah. but they are thinking about the return. And sociologists have noticed as they study this group with time that sometimes there's lots of inconsistencies with these narratives of return. Many do not return, but the idea of going back is there. And that creates, again, I think it enhances not only this sense of unbelonging, but also prevents some of these immigrants from developing strategic ways of building roots, you know, of growing roots here. It looks like there are some indications that it might be changing, but this myth of return, it's part of this sense of unbelonging as it expresses itself in these particular communities too.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And I bet that myth of return is largely tied to first generation, second generation, third generation. Because, I mean, I'm sure that my great-grandpa, who rode the rails from San Luis Potosí, and then one day decided, I guess I'll give it a go, was hoping one day to go back.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. Right?
And we've been here since 1912, right? Mm. Over 100, so we're not going back.
Yeah.
But, and we're in our third and fourth generation. Very few of us, my immediate family speak fluent English, fluent Spanish rather. And it's, I think it kind of lapses with time and also just the realities of you're no longer working for remittances to send those back. You're no longer mm-hmm. working to bring certain family members over. You're no longer working and my guess is that as that generational shift happens, right, is that the myth loosens its grip on the imagination, right?
That's right. No, that's wonderful. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, this is a new group, a new immigrant group, you know, which is interesting to do exactly. I mean, what you're doing to look at how this developed within Mexican American migration, for example, where's your fourth, fifth, you know, generation, some folks didn't cross the border crossed them.
Yeah.
and there's all kinds of differences here. There's just not the time and the numbers in these communities yet to have studies on 1.5 second, third generation. Will be interesting to see how that develops.
Yeah. Well, you know what? That's called job security. So that's what you want to plant your flag on that and go, you know what, that hasn't happened, but I'm just the person to start looking right at that. So yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I'm curious about this. You talked about the pastor. You did a lot of work with pastors to kind of mm-hmm. examine their outlook on maybe their own ethnicity, their own religious identity, and whether they saw themselves particularly as being indebted to helping this great undocumented group, whether they saw themselves even as in solidarity, not even with their own Brazilian brothers and sisters, but with other Latin Americans, right? And I found it fascinating that sometimes you didn't see that, right? That there's, as you mentioned in the book, that this pan-ethnic identity is not used. Do you think that's strictly language, or what else is going on there that there's maybe not as much solidarity as we would have thought examining a marginalized community would have naturally kind of mm-hmm. birthed that solidarity? Maybe it didn't, but explain that for us.
Oh yeah. That is fascinating too. I mean, I think it should be recognized that first generation immigrants from any country in general will prefer their national identities or identifiers than a pan-ethnic identity. So if given a choice, immigrants from Latin America, first generation immigrants would choose to be Mexican over Hispanic, Chilean over Hispanic, Peruvian over Hispanic. In that sense, that is overlap here. This is also true here, that national identifiers are preferred over pan-ethnic identifiers. I mean, it takes time to be socialized into pan-ethnic identities. But So second, third generations, they have a presumably an easier time because they already socialized into those names and, you know, rather than having to really think about how do you fit within that imagination. That said, the difference here is that Brazilians try to capitalize on what they see as the majority culture's positive perception of their culture. Whereas the U.S. form of white supremacy, for example, kind of influences people to think of Mexicans or Hispanics in extremely racist and negative ways. It does not the same to Brazilians. One example that I often cite is that in 2017, CNN had a list of the 10 coolest nationalities. Brazilian was the first and was the only Latinx nationality there.
Or Latin American nationality. You are pretty cool, Dr. Chavez. You are pretty cool.
Whoever did that list didn't go to Recife. they never been there. It's a romanticization. People think of carnival and soccer. There are so many different Brazils.
Of course.
That people have, and this is true here. I mean, it's true. Those are purely imaginary. but it is an imagination that might be socially advantageous,
right?
So the paradox here, and I criticize these communities here, is that by trying to capitalize in this constructed social imagination of the U.S. form of white supremacy that romanticizes Brazilian culture, these individuals internalize the very discriminations that put obstacles to their success in some ways, and pastors that have been here longer have noticed this. The Brazilian government, for example, have influenced, have used some pastors, some of them that I interview for this book, to talk to Brazilian communities so they can, during the census that happened, that they would check the Latino box and then talk about their nationalities. Pastors sometimes want to have a Spanish-speaking and a Portuguese-speaking ministry in their churches, and some of them had difficulties. Because of what they say, Brazilian ethnocentrism, they call Brazilian racism. So the pastors lament that, but it takes time to develop that awareness that is something to be lamented. And as migration fluxes change and fluctuate, the different communities navigate those things differently. But there is a strong ethnocentrism, especially from Brazilian immigrants who arrived not too long ago. And pastors haven't been here for a longer time, see the advantage of being within the Latinx, pan-ethnic, Hispanic, pan-ethnic identity, but also the foolishness of trying, to deny it, because by the time you explain you're from Brazil, so maybe so-and-so romanticizes you, they already looked at you. And many of us, you can tell the difference between Brazilian or Ecuadorian or Mexican. I mean, you're going to be socialized in a particular category, either you want it or not. So I mean, there are not only advantages in terms of coalition building, building racial ethnic solidarity that goes beyond your particular community, but there is also a set of foolishness in trying to incorporate internalize this white supremacist disposition that think of Hispanics as being less so. That I found, to my shock and sadness, happens so much in this community.
I think it broadly, I don't think a lot of Latinx Protestant Catholic communities have not come to terms with, you know, the very nature of Christianity as a colonial project. And that's been something that's not discussed. If it's discussed, it's used as a marker against people to say that if you don't fully accept this colonial past as its, you know, the glorious narratives are surrounding that with saints and martyrdom, et cetera. And if you don't complicate that with the very real pain that this colonization cost this continent, that we have even started to explore yet, really. I mean, I think some people have, you know, but it's not something that is talked about in churches that I've noticed, you know, and I've been studying churches a long time, and it's just not discussed, right? I think it's deeply, it's deep down in there somewhere, you know, but it's not something that's discussed. What do you self-identify as? Somebody ask you, what are you?
Well, I would say that I'm both Brazilian and Latinx.
Yeah.
And Hispanic. I have some Hispanics with whom I've been with have been more welcoming of Brazilians saying they are Latinos and they are Hispanic because of the Spanish language,
which I
learned Spanish working with Mexicans in the restaurant business in Texas, and I have been given the title of honorary Mexican. So I suppose that I can. By my coworkers. So I suppose I can claim Hispanic and Latino, but I do think me and other Brazilian scholars. I'm writing now with a sociologist friend for a textbook, a chapter on why Brazilians are Latinos, why Brazilians are Latinx, why you know, and fit in there. Because I do think that it's not only what makes sense. It's also a project. By project, I mean this intentional inclusion within a panethnic identity that has many practical benefits. I think it is just within the definition of Latinx folks, people who have heritage from Latin America. So in that sense, it makes no sense. It makes no sense to me what these immigrants in some of these communities have done, which is try to deny that fact, or at least try to overemphasize national identity to the extent their panethnic identities become irrelevant. And I know the panethnic identity I constructed. I know there is a history. I know, it's in the, second half of the 20th century for census purposes. I mean, those are socially constructed, categories. I get that. I'm not naive regarding that this is all constructed. Yeah. But I think it is a project that, although it is, because it is there in the way in which it is there, is one into which Brazilians would fit naturally. Although some of them have tried to deny it, and I kind of try to narrate and criticize some of that in the book.
We are talking with Dr. João Chaves, and his book is Migrational Religion, Baylor University Press. This is a Classical Ideas podcast, and I am guest hosting. My name is Arlene Sanchez-Walsh. This is the journey you pick for your pastors, or at least the one that you're kind of crafting for them as you've interviewed them, that there's a journey from a crisis to a discomfort to an acceptance and a defense of the undocumented. So maybe they start out with not wanting to get their hands dirty, let's just say, because it is messy. Immigration crisis in this country is endemic. It shows no sign of stopping. It is centuries old, and it probably, for political reasons, people don't want it stopped, right? They don't want it solved. They don't want the problem solved. And these pastors that you saw them go through this process, kind of describe that for us. If you can give us, put the name to one of these pastors, and tell us that story.
Yeah, that particular chapter, I do not mention the names of the pastors just because some of them say things that might get them in trouble.
Yes,
but it is a fascinating story of a few pastors that I trace. Some of them, interestingly, they are writing for denominational papers in Brazil while they are here. So they are mentioning their struggles here and how they are developing within that struggle. So they're for their audiences in Brazil. And others, talk about that in their own diaries, some of them in their, it shows in the minutes of their church, and some of them I had conversations with. One of them particularly, and I mentioned many of them in the chapter that I'll deal with this, he actually called immigration services when he got here, when he discovered. So he came to the church and then he finds out there are so many undocumented folks in the church, and he doesn't know what to do because on one end he has this moralistic Southern Baptist rooted theology that he learned in his Baptist seminary in Brazil. He comes and says, this is morally wrong, these people are against the law. What do I do? So he called immigration.
Wow.
And the immigration officer told him, what is in the sign in front of your church? And he said the name of the church. And this is how he recalled the conversation. And the immigration agent said, well, can then be a pastor, let us be immigration agents.
Wow. Right.
So so he got pastoral lessons, I say, in the book from an immigration officer. Talking to this pastor, he goes from there to campaigning for Hillary Clinton from his pulpit because of what Trump will do to immigrants.
Yes, that was a fascinating story.
Yeah, and I asked him, weren't you scared of losing your 501c3, you know, your tax-exempt status by doing partisan politics from the pulpit? And he said, no, I will risk anything for my people.
That's quite a shift. It's quite a change.
It is a very, very big shift. And another pastor that I talk about, his moment of enlightenment, if I could put it that way, or of where the crisis tipped the point for him.
Yes.
He was walking in a brick paver street in Florida. He's one of those who write to Brazil, and he's recounting that. And he said, a lot of people who do brick pavers in Florida are Brazilian immigrants. Mm-hmm. And he was like, so I'm walking in the streets and I'm thinking my salary is paid for by these people who work in these harsh conditions and do this construction work. And why, and what am I, going to do with this? And then he goes on and he begins reflecting on the dreamers, you know, the people who, the adolescents who came because they were brought by their parents, but now can't go to college. So he's having to wrestle with that. So he starts there. And then clearly he moves to everybody. You know, this is not wrong just for these kids. There's no morality in this legislation itself. You know, so
right.
And then he criticizes Bush. Mm-hmm. He said even presidents like Bush, who claim they are Christian, do not, you know, kind of, although Bush tried to push for immigration reform, right? He says, the rule, I'm paraphrasing here, but I quote him in the book, says the what rules in the U.S. is the dollar. You know, so this awareness that there is some profit to be gained from this situation. It's not about doing, you know, what's best or what's Christian. Even when we have a Christian president, it is how these dynamics inform, the structures of power and profit.
Right. Very good. Well, the last few minutes, I'm one of the topics that I have immersed myself in for way too long, over 20 years now, but I was fascinated by this chapter, this Pentecostalization. And, you know, when you think about Pentecostalism, to kind of set the table broadly, in terms of Protestantism, Pentecostals and Baptists, not in the same league, you know, not very, very different theologies, very, very different dynamics. Same missionary and evangelical zeal, for sure, for conversions. You found this in the churches that you were studying, is that essentially what has happened in a lot of Latin American Protestantism, which is this Pentecostalization phenomenon, was brought over through these migration patterns, or did it exist here already? What did you find?
Yeah, so in these churches are very interesting because you are right that although there are some early connections between Baptists and Pentecostals in Brazil, for example, you have the Assemblies of God that begins in Brazil via Swedish immigrants who went to William Durham's church in Chicago, was a Baptist.
Right.
And they go to Eric Nelson's, a Southern Baptist missionary who is Swedish, but is in Brazil. Mm-hmm. They go to his church because they are Swedish also. They try to convert the church to Pentecostalism. And there's a problem. There's a split. They leave. That's how the Assemblies of God, that's the biggest denomination in Brazil today, kind of begins. As a matter of fact, one of a recent history of the Assemblies of God, the historian says, Gedeon Alencar, a very respected historian, he says that the Assemblies of God in Brazil has to deny and to go against Baptists and Baptist against them because they're actually so much alike, you know, in some ways. So what happens then, that idea or that story, and we talked about how narratives are deployed and used, right? So this narrative of the Pentecostals trying to usurp the Baptist church, you know, and that Eric Nelson keeps on being redeployed as they are the enemy within, but they are fierce competitors, certainly. Mm-hmm. And then in the 1960s, the Southern Baptist missionary, a single woman, widow, by the name of Rosalie Mills Appleby, who is very much into the Keswick movement, but the Keswick ideas, might not have been charismatic herself, starts mentoring folks who end up becoming charismatic / Pentecostals from the 50s to the 60s. That causes a split within the Brazilian Baptist denomination. Mm-hmm. And then you have two denominations there, one that is charismatic, the National Baptist Convention, and the Brazilian Baptist Convention that is not only non-charismatic, but has been historically anti-charismatic, anti-Pentecostal.
Yeah.
So you have these pastors that come here, they come with that mentality from the Brazilian Baptist Convention, that they are not Pentecostal.
Okay.
But the problem they face is that the majority of, because of the way that migration dynamics have played out, and there are some studies that about Brazilian migration that suggest that Pentecostals migrate in much larger numbers than any other religious sensibility in Brazil. So what happened is this migrants come in, and many times the Baptist churches in these communities in the cities they go to are the oldest churches. They have been there. They're most established, sometimes the only one. Mm-hmm. They end up going to a Baptist church, not because they're Baptist, but because they're Brazilian.
Yeah.
And that's the only Brazilian church there. And then you have the issue of the Baptist polity, which is allegedly democratic. People vote on things. So then what happens when you have a huge number of Pentecostals? They outnumber anybody else in the church that's struggling to remain Baptist because the pastor, maybe the treasurer is Baptist and a few other members, but the great majority of folks are Pentecostal. Well, they have to negotiate that. So I went to a multi-site church in the Bay Area, for example, and I went to there, I frequented their Wednesday night service. So the Sunday service, there was not a lot of speaking in tongues, sometimes here and there, not every Sunday, but you go to the pastor was a Baptist, trained in a Baptist seminary from the Baptist convention, would deny he was Pentecostal. But then you go to the Wednesday service that was led by his co-pastor, and he was ordained by the Four Square Church. The literature that we would read was from CPAD, which is the publishing house of the Assemblies of God in Brazil. And their leadership was there being trained in that mentality. And another pastor who was pastored a mega church in Florida, he would say, well, I try to control if how people become more or less Pentecostal by the way in which I invite speakers. So I try to control so that they don't take over, he mentioned. But in Wednesday services, week services, they can have fully Pentecostal service. That's how I negotiate the fact, and this is his language, he would say, and let's go negotiate the fact that there are so many of them and they are happy here, but they don't take over.
Oh, you know? Yeah, so, well, that's just so pragmatic. It's just, and so typically, you know, Protestant, well, typically religious, right? I mean, because you're dealing with competition and you don't want to lose. There's the language is a very capitalist language of losing and gaining and controlling and market share almost, right? So as long as they have their share, you know, they won't take over, right? And so you're trying to keep your shareholders happy, if you will, in this context, right? So it's just really interesting how all of this plays out. And of course, in the larger scheme of it, the narratives and the language is always about maintaining purity, maintaining this fealty to certain theological positions that are immovable. And as we know, for those of us who study religion long enough, almost everything is movable, right?
That's
almost
right.
Almost everything is negotiable. Everything's right. Negotiable. No, let's just say it. Everything's negotiable.
Yeah. That is completely right. And it's very interesting because some of the pastors would say, my church is not Baptist. There's the name Baptist out there, but really, we are not Baptist. And then, and some of them would say, I like the neo-Pentecostals or the, you know, the third wave of Brazilian Pentecostalism,
sure, sure.
The more indigenous, you know, kind of ones. I like them a lot because they are used to respect their pastors. Baptists don't respect their pastors. Pentecostals do. So, you know, a couple of them said, so I like them and they like it here. Mm-hmm. So there is now we used to be the only one pastor told me we used to be the only Brazilian church here. Now there are others, but the Pentecostals stayed because they like the way we do things. And I like them because they respect the pastors a lot more than Baptists. So I'm not looking for Baptists. If Pentecostals want to stay here in my church, there's the Baptist sign in the front, but I'm just fine with that. So again, extremely pragmatic. And some of them do not want to loosen their Baptist affiliation for another pragmatic market-driven reason, which is that sometimes they do get benefits, financial benefits and otherwise, from being affiliated to the Southern Baptist Convention. But they also would say, as they said, and I quote them in the book, saying, well, we are affiliated with them. They are a big mama, but if they come here and see what we are doing, they are going to say, kick them out.
Yeah, so just make sure they don't visit, or make sure they visit on those, make sure they visit on the Sundays where, you know, the more traditional Baptists are in charge. Like, go to Sunday, don't go to Wednesday, right? I mean, that's you're trying to maintain that control. Yeah. Another thing about Pentecostalization in Latin America, as you know, is that Pentecostalism, at least one of the theories of why it grows, and we've all been trying to solve this issue for, well, solving is probably a wrong word there, but we've been trying to understand why it grows, if you will. And one of the ideas happens to be, you know, that women find auxiliary roles, not only auxiliary roles of power, but they find roles of being pastors in some of these churches. And for our listeners, to my knowledge, the Brazilian Baptists that you study do not ordain women. So could it possibly be that maybe there's an auxiliary role for women in this Pentecostalization process where they're finding sources of power in the churches that you studied, where they might not find it in the official kind of roles of the Baptist church?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a fascinating question. I mean, the short answer is I don't know, but I have an opinion.
Sure.
Just one thing about the Brazilian Baptist Convention, and this is the one point in which they nod towards a difference from the Southern Baptists, is that they have allowed the state chapters of their order of pastors to decide if they're going to ordain women or not. So, so you can, if you are in São Paulo, for example, in Brazil, the order of pastors might ordain women, whereas if it was in Minas Gerais, the order of pastors of that state might not.
Okay.
They allow for state convention, so to speak, autonomy there. But here, these churches are officially Southern Baptist churches. Like they are affiliated to, because the Brazilian Baptist Convention does not allow for Baptist churches outside the Brazilian territory to be affiliated to them. And as I tell in the book, some of the churches here try to force them to change the bylaws. And the argument was, again, they by contributed in dollar, they will be contributing more than a lot of states in Brazil contribute. So why not change it? We don't want to be Southern Baptist. We want to be Brazilian Baptist. Change it. We're going to contribute money. Let it happen. But then because of some missionary involvement and others involvement of the Southern Baptist Convention, there was the opposition and it didn't go through. But that, but all of that to say that in the churches here, some of them have ordained women, and the association for Baptist pastors in North America. When I finished the kind of I stopped doing the ethnographic work around 2017, they were on the verge of deciding to officialize that amongst them. Some churches do have women ordained pastors. But it's interesting when you talk to, and I did make a point of talking to pastors who had just arrived and some who were here for longer. Those who just arrived are shocked by this. You know, this one of them told me, we are trained in the same seminaries. We have the same Reformed theology. I don't know what happens. They become liberalized here. And he's right to an extent. They do become liberalized, and part of this, I argue, is not only the fact that there is more women leadership that comes with the Pentecostalization itself, but also there is more women financial independence here than comparatively in Brazil. And I think that forces that forces these leaders to rethink how they're going to approach that very important, most numerous, most committed sector of their communities of women.
Right. We are talking to Dr. João Chaves, and his book is Migrational Religion, Baylor University Press, on something that doesn't get, I guess, kneaded into the great big dough that we're trying to build here, if you will, mixing metaphors. Of Latinx religion, you know, is Brazilian religion. It's, even when it's studied globally, it's separate unto itself. But as you know, we have to talk about Afro-Brazilian. We have to talk about race. We have to talk about all kinds of things. It is much more complicated than maybe a lot of US-based students or researchers have given it a good look, because it is definitely complex. It's almost like a if you're doing geology, right? Just layers and layers and layers of an uncovering it that's often not, it's not a part of our broader discussions, right? It's not a part of our broader conferences. It's not a part of our broader research networks. It's kind of separated onto itself. And I would like to think that part of that is language, right? That you, there's plenty and plenty of wonderful researchers and scholars that we both know who are fluent in Spanish and can read those documents and those archives, less so Portuguese, right? And so maybe part of it might be just pragmatic, very practical, is that some of us just don't have the tools. But it's just, it's fascinating work. It really is. And I'm glad that you did it. I really am. I mean, I read it and going, you know, there's some links here, and then there's some differences. And then there's some links to other Latinx groups, and then there's not, right? I mean, if you want to encapsulate for us, what's just the most interesting finding that you had in your research that you would like others to know? Maybe those of us who've danced around Latinx religion, those listening to the podcast who are really whetting their appetites for the first time in this subfield, for lack of a better word. What do you want us to, a big takeaway?
Well, thank you for that question. I haven't thought about that in terms of, in this broader terms of the field, but I do think there was what was surprising here to me in some ways. a few things. One of them is how this group that is circumscribed within a loosely defined denominational sensibility, right? How interested it was to see how they organized here and tried to pressure the denomination back in their host country by using the privileges, financial and otherwise, that these communities have obtained in the U.S. Because some of these churches, like I can mention a few of them, that they started as small congregations of brother, predominantly white churches, and end up buying the whole campus of the church. I mean, there are some church, some of these churches are very large, and they have become kind of powerhouses in a way of these kinds of transnational Brazil-U.S. networks, and sometimes they have pressured the convention back home to change from here. This was very interesting to me how sometimes you see I wonder how common that is, because there is a move, and there are good reasons for this, from studying denominations to studying networks. I understand why, and I think it's something that needs to continue, but one thing that one kinds of lose in this post-denominational turn is seeing how these networks or these communities of immigrants abroad sometimes try to exert their power in other parts of the world and in their home country as well. So that was a really, really interesting to me. I do not know how common that is, it'll be interesting to me to kind of understand that, to see more of these denominationally bounded studies, to see if this happens and to what extent it happens. Connected to this is the idea of a transnational reputation as well. Pastors who got in trouble here had issues in Brazil, because the leaders here made a point to go back and publish everywhere that the person who pastored here shouldn't be trusted for this and that. Same thing, vice versa, right? So, yeah. I mean, I think that the depth and the width of the way in which these communities really live simultaneously in two worlds, really comes to light in studies like this. Another thing, and I'll stop with two because I know I can go on. another thing that I found very interesting is in this particular group, and I say this in a sentence, I say that my claim is that in terms of Brazilian Baptists, the closer they get to the Southern Baptist geographically, the farther they get from them ideologically. And because the migration dynamic, and they start to notice that. One thing that I've been thinking a lot about, and I do not have an answer to this, but I think that this kind of insight from this book kind of start me in that direction, is thinking about how in evangelicalism, particularly evangelicalism of the United States brand, with all its power and influence, exerts its influence easier from a distance, without having these evangelical communities experiencing them on a daily basis, what their political commitments mean to people who look like you and who come from where you come from. What do white supremacy feels like when you're a neighbor to this? What does it mean to have this Southern Baptist denomination that you used to worship in the seminary that you were trained, have come to you, like it happened to one of these pastors, have the pastor of the church that is hosting you come to you and say, when you are walking on a sidewalk, we want you to move to the other one, because we don't want to walk in the same sidewalk as you,
That's
right. I wonder, in a more conceptual level that I didn't pursue here, But at least in this particular group, it seems that in the, which is the Southern Baptist Convention that has tremendous power mm-hmm. in Brazil as well, mm-hmm. It's still today in some very important ways. How they, the mechanism by which they maintain the kind of colonial mentality, theologically colonialism, or theologically colonial mentality back in Brazil is facilitated by distance, and it would be problematized by proximity. Proximity complexifies, makes it harder to sustain this this idea that these theologies are adequate for living life in the Latin American context. I think that this is something that needs to be fleshed out, but that I've been thinking about, that is true here, but I do not know what that means at a broader conceptual sure. level. Hopefully sure. I'll have some time to think about that more in the future.
Well, that is great. That's just really interesting. I never even thought of that. But yeah, no, I mean, that's now all of these little pastors and folks who I've talked to over the years just come to mind now with all of the kind of like, what is the theology of the slight, right? The theology of you know, the hot term is microaggression, right? But it's like mm-hmm. stripping it of the language. It's like, it's when you slight someone, it's when you insult someone, it's when you hurt their pride. It's when you essentially the first time you see someone close up and you realize that they're not what you thought they were, right? And that they're, and that the very basic kind of basic sustenance of Christian life of neighborliness and helping people out and being a good person, right? Stripped of all the theological language of just trying to make you and me better is kind of tossed on its head because, again, we don't deal adequately with the colonial nature of what this religion has done to the Americas and what's been done to it by Americans of all stripes, right? And it's, we don't really complexify that at all, right? That's a tough one.
It is a very tough one. I mean, if you go deep enough in that direction and how it even changes the way in which we obtain and create knowledge, right? How having a book from a university press in some ways is part of an adaptation into the realities and structures that very colonialism sort of create and establish and names what is excellence. And I mean, there's so much to be kind of peeled from that it's and it certainly influences these communities here in deep ways.
That's right. Thank you so much for this discussion. I have been speaking with Dr. Zhao Chavez, and the title of the book is Migrational Religion, Baylor University Press. This is a Classical Ideas podcast. Thank you again. I haven't seen you since Texas. And
that's
you don't look any worse for wear. I'm in my closet. I'm in my closet, but I'm going to turn on my camera now so you can see. Hopefully you can see. Yeah, it's been fun. It's been a lot of fun. I know, and you see clothes. It's so embarrassing. But yeah, really good stuff. Thank you so much for this. And I hope to see you again real soon. I'm going to be looking for some more good stuff from you in the future because this is one of the things that I, you know, I could read this stuff for days, as you know, just anything about religion and ethnicity, just like,
yeah.
Absolutely. Thanks again.
Well, thank you very much. You're very kind. Thank you for your time. And again, I also hope to see you again, maybe for coffee in the future when we are really, really post-COVID. I would love that very much.
Absolutely. Okay. Thanks a lot.